I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. Warning, this podcast contains my first impressions of the latest episode of The Mandalorian, Season 3, Episode 2, Chapter 18, The Mines of Mandalore.
Roaring fires, malt beer, red meat off the bone. This, my friend, is the home of my cousin Balin, and they call it a mine. A mine!
This is no mine. It's a tomb.
Yeah, if there ever was a futuristic entry into the Lord of the Rings universe, I'd believe you if you said this was it. That, dear friends, is not even close to being a slight. There wasn't much to this episode, but I really do think this was a really important episode, and it takes the story in places we've not seen, shows us things I've never thought we'd see, and it was a really enjoyable episode, especially if you like a little romance thrown in with your Star Wars.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Don't worry, I will explain what I mean when I say romance in Star Wars. It's not overt. There's just an undercurrent that I think has been building, and I think we're at the point now where a family unit might be forming right in front of our eyes. Let's get to the episode and maybe the evidence will build, or maybe it won't. Maybe I'm just seeing what I want to see. First, we get the previously on segments, and they've done a great job of setting up context for each episode. And this week, it starts with more from the Book of Boba Fett. I think they really are concerned people didn't watch that show. But if you're watching The Mandalorian, you're probably going to watch the Book of Boba Fett. Maybe you just didn't stick around for the fifth episode. Maybe you got bored with what you saw at the beginning. I didn't. I certainly did not. I watched the entire series. But we're shown in the previously on what's later described as a fusion explosion. It looks like an atom bomb went off. We're told that redemption's no longer possible because the mechanism for it isn't possible anymore. In order for atonement, remember, Din Djarin has to bathe in the living waters beneath the mines of Mandalore, so saith the Armorer. The Book of Boba Fett made things very clear, but Favreau, Filoni, executive producer Rick Famuyiwa are reminding us this is what they've set up, or we have been led to believe, is the goal for Din Djarin. The more the show progresses, though, we really do have to consider, as some of us have been saying, the title of the show, The Mandalorian, might not refer to just one person. We hear about Bo-Katan from the Armorer in the previously on segment. I'm not suggesting that The Mandalorian refers to her either the Armorer or Bo-Katan. But what if the titles of the show have not been referring to Din Djarin and Grogu's journey? Okay, that's probably silly. The titles of the show obviously refer to what's been happening in the episodes that we've been watching, but what if there's a double meaning, is what I'm saying. Okay, Din tells Bo-Katan in the previously on, I'm going to Mandalore, I'm seeking redemption. He has a hope she no longer has.
Bo-Katan, I am going to Mandalore.
That planet has been ravaged, plundered, and poisoned. There's nothing left.
Those are two different lines spliced together, but the context is the same. And I think she's just been waiting for someone with what she senses as a purity of their soul to unlock that hope that she still does have deep inside. I think we're going to have to wait and see. When the episode begins, it's Tatooine. Now, are the shots from Mos Eisley or Mos Espa? Because there's like a Grand Prix happening in town. It's the Boonta Eve races. But we know Pelimato's garage was in Mos Eisley. But Boba Fett has things going in Mos Espa. It's a big town. And I know Palimato has warmed and she's fond of the Mandalorian. I don't like this grift she's running on other people. Now, without context, the Rodian, wealthy or not, this Rodian is getting swindled. I don't want to root for someone like Palimato if she's doing this. So it kind of took away from me being glad to see the character. And hey, I noticed, I don't know if you did, she's got a tooth missing. That's something you see in the Book of Boba Fett. When the droid rickshaw gets knocked over, her tooth pops out. She like takes it out of her mouth, like spits it on the ground. I like the Jawa-ese that she talks. I like her shtick. And I didn't always like it, but I like it. It's grown on me.
Dated a Jawa for a while. They're quite furry. Very furry.
She threw around some creature names when talking about Grogu and the N1. And so I wanted to figure out what this Nuzzle Shrew was. And 6 days ago, there was an article on a website called The Hindu that mentioned that creature. So that writer actually, I guess, was at the premiere, the 2-episode premiere, and didn't care at all about any possible embargoes. And if you had been reading that article, well, then you had everything basically spoiled for you in episode 2. But I had no idea about this website before searching for what was a Nuzzle Shrew. Lerman, though, we have seen. Those were a creature in the Clone Wars, and they are sentient, and I think they spoke basic, from what I remember. The big mention, though, Pelly wondering, hey, are you back to take out Boba Fett? I mean, would he do such a thing on Bunta Eve? It immediately made me start wondering, why would she bring that up?
I'm here on business.
Oh, are the Hutts back? Are you taking out Boba Fett?
We hear that she's going to remod the ship to put in an astromech port. That was something I speculated on before the season. Like, well, we know that we see the droid in there, so we know he's going back to Palimato. We know that that's going to happen. So we knew it was coming from the trailers. We knew that R5 was going to join him, even if just briefly. I figured his next stop would be here for the part that he's looking for. But we basically hear, hey, if the Jawas can't find it, no one can. So thus endeth the quest? I mean, what are the Anzons going to do now? I would be shocked if we don't end up seeing a repurpose of IG-11's body, either with a new personality, reconfigured into some new droid altogether. Remember, they're droid smiths? Or, and I shudder to think that this actually might happen, what if they turn it into like an Iron Man-style armor? Or like the mechanized beast that we see in this episode, like what if it's a mech suit for a small pilot? I am trying to prepare myself for that mentally. So if that happens, you know, right now I'm thinking if that happens, I'll be disappointed. But if it happens and it's cool, then do I change my mind? I'm really struggling with that, but I really feel like that's coming. Where Palimato is saying the first word stuff, I don't think Grogu said Peli at all.
Who taught you how to leap like a Lerman, huh? Was that his first word? I think he's talking to me. Did you hear that? He said Peli.
It says babbling right there in the closed captioning, so no, he didn't say Peli, but it's cute, the interactions that she has. And then she's going to send Grogu and Din Djarin off with R5. But he's got fragile circuitry, I think she says.
Uncle Owen?
Yeah?
This R2 unit has a bad motivator. Look.
Hey, what are you trying to push on us?
So yeah, of course, we know that he had a bad motivator in New Hope. And now she's pawning him off on him, or you know, hey, I can give him to you for a steal, basically. So, I mean, we saw this coming from the trailers, right? We saw kind of this eventuality. You could almost see it in your head how it was going to turn out. And it works. I mean, it's okay. It gets us to where we're supposed to be. Peli gives a "May the Force be with you" as the N1 takes to the night sky, and there's this fireworks display, vaguely reminiscent of the celebrations, you know, at the end of Return of the Jedi. But the real thing was, this is where we get the title card. The chapter's called "The Minds of Mandalore," and that is the first time I thought, okay, definitely, this is a Lord of the Rings inspiration here. It wouldn't be the last time I thought that. So I love the father and son dynamic on navigation lessons, and Din Djarin describing where they are is not only poignant for the overall story, but it describes where they are in the universe for us. So the viewers, we know what's going on, and it served a story purpose for the episode because it tells us how, without words, Grogu is able to communicate with R5 and to get them back to Bo-Katan later. Remember, he's not talking basic. We just heard from Pelimoto. Is that his first word? He's not speaking. Droids aren't able to understand him, but somehow he had to be able to point to something and tell, hey, take me here, right?
Looks like the fusion bombs from the Purge disrupted the magnetic field around the planet. From the surface, we won't be able to communicate with anyone out of atmosphere, so we have to be careful. Down here, we're completely cut off from the rest of the galaxy.
I really appreciate Favreau's efficiency with his lines of dialogue. They're not just thrown in there. They are setting the stakes, establishing the rules we have for the episode. So lines like that, you know, we have to be careful and we can't contact them. They're all serving a purpose. And I like that there was this little Star Trek-like moment where the droid had to read the atmosphere. You know, I liked that little, you know, nod to kind of start with, like, oh, it's breathable, Captain. So that way we don't have to go down in, you know, special suits or anything like that. And in this case, our story can continue. And Din Djarin even says Bo-Katan was right. Just last episode, he was questioning her story to her face. The way the episode was developing, it was kind of setting up, it was like setting up an uncomfortable moment and then either building on that or making us relax. So it was a great job of cinematography and a great job of the story beats because it kept me uncomfortable. But I'm just not a fan of thrillers and horror movies as a rule. Well, at least the bad ones. I mean, a good one, I'll sit through, like Signs by Mel Gibson. I thought that was a good movie. I thought there was a lot of uncomfortableness there, but I felt like we were being led along. And, you know, I do like happy endings. There's no denying that. But then there are some movies that they're just there to shock you and just there to upset you and jump scares. And this was not the vibe I was getting. There were a couple of vibes I was getting, though. It was like the Lord of the Rings, of course, but then also the time machine. I thought we were going to find out that those creatures that first attack Din Djarin and Grogu, or Din Djarin and R5, rather, I thought they were going to be mutated Mandalorians that were wearing different masks or something, but that is not the case. They are, well, we hear later, they're Alamites, and they were native to the planet, and they were underneath the surface. And then I guess because there's nobody else around, then they start coming closer to the surface. And then there are also small dragon-like creatures too. So this is, you know, not a feral place, but the wildness is coming back to the planet now that people aren't living there. The suspense, delving into the depths of the bombed-out city, it did. It had me on edge. You know, I kept waiting for moments like that creature coming out and capturing Din Djarin. But first, he like pulls out the Darksaber, lighting it on Mandalore for the first time in quite some time. And that moment was not lost on me. The blade has this long, I guess, sordid past with the planet. Now it was home. I thought, maybe this is to show us there was some recognition of this blade from the creatures that were still alive on the planet. But no, it didn't turn out to be that. The creature inside the mech was much more alien to me. It had a really creepy, creepy eye thing. My first thoughts were, you know, how is this creature on the planet at all? But then I thought, okay, this is something that was left by the Empire to weed out survivors. Like, they had this creature. They, you know, they were using it. They transported it here just so it could, you know, take the blood, you know, capture a true-blooded Mandalorian, maybe a peaceful one, not a warlike one, and then take the blood and then use that blood to suspend itself, like the eye floating inside that protective case. It was super creepy. It made me very uncomfortable. I was terrified, even though I knew nothing's going to happen here. Like, the show's not going to end after the second episode of the third season. But that's probably the problem that I had most with the scene was, I know there's no stakes here, but also there's no way Grogu escapes, finds Bo-Katan, and comes back in time for her to rescue him. Sorry, but the time just doesn't work. He should definitely be dead. I mean, it's a huge stretch of disbelief that I'm willfully making based on goodwill the show has already earned from previous episodes. I mean, there's no way that he could have gotten back, but I'm okay with it because the show doesn't do this that often, in my opinion. We checked another scene off from the trailers with Grogu knocking back and attacking Alamite, you know, out of the cave and out of his way.
Let's get rid of him once and for all.
When we get back to Bo-Katan and she says that what she said, I thought she meant she was going to attack the ship, and I was a little bit nervous for little Grogu that he was going to have to suddenly display some piloting prowess. Instead, she just comes out with, like, I thought I told you not to come back. It was awkward in my opinion, but I liked it.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear the last time. I want to be left alone. What happened to him? Download the astromech, find out where they were.
Not attacking allowed her to display this compassion to Grogu, like, where's your daddy at? She didn't say that, of course. So she takes him and R5 in her ship. I think it's called the Gauntlet. And this is, I think, the ship that we end up seeing in the trailer that is evading TIE fighters on Kalevala. So that's going to have to come later, right? Maybe on the return, she takes them back. And then, oh, we've got to, you know, evade this, what might be the remnants of the First Order. Or I'm not really sure. I have the feeling that the next episode is not going to pick back up where we leave off. I think it's some other people are going to come in, and then we're going to come back to they're chasing Bo-Katan because they think she's got the Darksaber, and that's why those TIE fighters. Anyway, we'll get to that when that episode comes. But I wonder if people noticed when she was going down onto the planet that she had a smile on her face when she was talking about her homeworld and talking about returning. This is a big deal. That's not a small detail, I think. She's showing she's still got feelings. No matter how much we saw her moping in the last episode, there is still this love of her planet. Maybe it's the love of the leadership that she thinks she, you know, deserves. I think it goes with, like, so she goes in, and then she comes upon the creature. She grapples the Darksaber when she's down on the ground. She wielded it so effortlessly. I thought, this is the moment. This is when we see she is worthy of this blade. Now, after the scene, Din Djarin reclaims the lightsaber, the Darksaber. So, no, not that at all. But I really felt like that's what we were being led to believe. Not having any idea what was coming, though, meant I had no idea where Din was going to awaken when he passes out. So she could have taken him back to Kalevala, or taken him to the covert, or any number of things. Instead, Bo-Katan not only showed up when she said she didn't want to go, she rescues Din Djarin, and then she volunteers to stay and show him the way. Oh, she does that in more ways than one, though, right? Doesn't she? She shows him the true way. She tells the stories. But I wonder if people noticed there was no mention of Satine. Not any mention. This is her sister, or at least what we're led to believe was her sister from the Clone Wars. I mean, we were told that in the Clone Wars. She's a former ruler of the planet from the Clone Wars and Rebels. Satine was killed by Maul, a lover of Obi-Wan Kenobi. No mention at all. I mean, what are we doing here? I get it. She hasn't been seen in a live action, but is that why? I mean, are we waiting to, like, cast Cate Blanchett in season 4 for a flashback or something?
I would have liked to have known him.
He was a great man. He died defending Mandalore.
This is the way.
What are you looking at?
I get it. That's something that probably most people didn't notice if they're not huge fans and didn't watch all the Clone Wars and the Rebels and stuff like that. And if you're not familiar with Bo-Katan's story, I highly recommend you go back, listen to all the dialogue from after Din wakes up at the campsite until he walks into the water. There's some important stuff in there. The journey of this show is not changing. It remains. The destination, however, we're seeing that develop right before our eyes. We're hearing from the two most important Mandalorians at this point in the culture's history about what it means to be a Mandalorian. And what does it take and why should we be remembered? We're hearing, I mean, we hear, this is the way. The way is embrace what unified us from our past traditions, observe them, respecting our recent trials, tribulations, tragedies, and then create a new society and form a triumph.
Here you go. The living waters. Hold on. I want you to get the full tour. These mines date back to the age of the first Mandalore. According to ancient folklore, the mines were once a Mythosaur lair. Mandalore the Great is said to have tamed the mythical beast. It is from these legends that the Skull Signet was adopted and became the symbol of our planet. This is it.
I wanted Din to take off his helmet. Like, I know what... I know the purpose of him going here was to atone for taking off his helmet. But I wanted him to take it off and realize in the moment. But what ends up happening would have killed him if it wasn't the case. Now, I noticed he didn't ask her, like, how do I do this? He just decided, this is how I'm going to bathe in the waters. Like, he didn't take off his armor. He left it on. He left on his helmet. Obviously, I guess for him, leaving on the helmet was important because that's why he was coming to atone. But he took his weapons off, his jetpack, not his helmet or his armor. And that was, of course, a mistake, taking off everything and you know, the jetpack and everything. But he's approaching this custom with innocence, purity of heart. Bo-Katan is watching, right? And she's kind of scoffing, like, huh, what are you doing here? But then she's almost amazed, like, oh, like, he's a believer. He's a true believer in this. I think she's thinking, you can still lead Mandalore. Like, you can still have this idealized view. Now, we didn't hear any mention of the sister, so it's totally different from her sister's idealized view of Mandalorians. But when he ends up disappearing into the depths, like he steps off and, you know, he was expecting another step and there wasn't one and he went down, right? She didn't hesitate. She put her helmet on and she dove right in. Now, this is where, you know, being a Christian, you see a little bit of the allegory in it. Baptisms don't work. Like, you can't just get baptized and be saved. You have to be saved. And then the baptism is the outward display, right? So Din is seeking redemption, but he doesn't know how, really, to get that redemption. And then Bo-Katan knows how, right? She said, I did all the customs and I didn't embarrass my dad, but she's not going and seeking redemption. She's not submerging herself because she's not seeking that redemption, but she has the knowledge. So she dives in to save him. It's not her baptism, really, but I think that's why it's her that sees the miracle. She sees the miracle. She sees this mythosaur. It's literally called a mythosaur. She sees this beast. He doesn't. He's the believer. He went and atoned for his past sin of taking off his helmet. She went in. She's not a believer, or she was at one time. She's the apostate, right? She's the one who left all that behind. But she gets to see the miracle. This is the beast that we see represented as a skull when we hear about the Mandalorians. You know, and then we see the beast. It's like Star Wars Episode 1, Phantom Menace, when Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan and Jar Jar go through the planet core of Naboo, and we see that creature's eye open up. We see this beast below, but it's not attacking. And I don't know what the symbolism of that is, or if this is a violent creature at all, but it was there. Was it hibernating? Did it come back closer to the surface from deeper, unknown depths? Or did it just awaken just now? And it was there all along, but people just stopped looking for it. I mean, there's so much symbolism that I'm really, really excited to find out. But I think we're getting a different kind of episode next week.
I swear on my name. And the names of the ancestors. That I shall walk the way of the Mandalore. And the words of the creed shall be forever forged in my heart.
Yes, those are my initial thoughts on Season 3, Episode 2 of The Mandalorian. But I think we're getting a look at the New Republic next week. I would bet on it. I really feel like we're going to not come back to this right away. I think this is where we go visit the core worlds. So it's either going to be Coruscant or Hosnian Prime or maybe even Chandrilla. Wherever we're going next, I don't think it's going to be picking back up this story. We will eventually. But there's either going to be one or two episodes, maybe more, who knows, where we're going to go see Carson Teva and we're going to hear his line from the trailers and we're going to hear more about how there's this growing threat, which we know is the First Order. We're probably going to see Pershing, probably going to see Moff Gideon. Maybe he talks his way out of a tribunal. And I think possibly what will happen is he's going to resume his quest. He's going to start to seek it. Like, I need that Darksaber back. I need to control Mandalorians. I need to do whatever it is. He's now going to have to atone because he's damaged goods to what is becoming the First Order. He's got no power. He lost his ship. He lost his power. I think we're going to see now a different baptism or baptism by fire. And I think we're going to visit different characters for a couple episodes because it's going to build where they're going to come together. That's just my opinion. I could totally be wrong. But those are my thoughts. And there was no feedback last week, so there was no feedback episode. I didn't receive any questions or comments about the episode. So please, send me some so I can do some work. thisisthewaypodcast@gmail.com. All of our links can be found in one place. linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. Our Twitter, Instagram links, @thisisthewaypod. There are links on the link tree to our Twitch, Facebook, anchor.fm, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now YouTube too. Hey, this is the way. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo. Thanks for listening to This Is The Way Podcast's first impressions on Season 3, Episode 2 of The Mandalorian, The Minds of Mandalore. May the Force be with you always.